Got your Starbucks? Can we go to work now? I mean, recess is over. I mean, this is a good school. We've had 2 hours and 10 minutes of recess. These various star books, to you that are very serious students, and you want to pick them up, they're available. The Witness of the Stars by E.W. Bullinger. The book that was given to you, you know about it, The Glory of the Stars by E. Raymond Capt. The two classics in the area that are most popular is the Bullinger book I've told you about and Joseph A. Seiss. If you pick up Seiss, try it again. If you pick up Seiss's book, probably Bullinger will give you the most solid foundation. Seiss will tie in various mythological accounts that are derivatives from the stars. We have gotten into the Book of Enoch at various times, the Apocryphal Book of Enoch, which is quoted by Jude. You that have read in the Book of Enoch know that if there is any substance to it at all, and the stumbling stone of the Book of Enoch is, you can't kick it out all the way, because there's no question but what the New Testament quotes from it, and I spent one whole festival here one night going through the sections of the New Testament. Every single New Testament writer that relies upon the Book of Enoch. There are some problems in that, and that's the problem with all biblical scholarship. And until someone's willing to give a little more serious attention to the book, the scholarship problems will not be resolved. Do we have the particular book intact that the New Testament drew upon and was using? You that have been reading the Book of Enoch that we've referenced in our teaching know that there are sections after you get through the first few chapters that represent a vision and an account of a vision by Noah. Is this a compilation of several books, and did the original Book of Enoch only contain the first sections, and did later renditions add other and additional sections? There are problems of scholarship, and the neglect of the book has forced a neglect of the scholarship. I am not yet ready to throw Enoch out with the bathwater. As with so many things that we've been teaching, we seek to rescue the truth from the stuff that surrounds it. Never once, in spite of what people might think, will I veer a quarter turn from the starting point, which is the Book of God that I preach from these many years. I could preach the same truths with only one book. I'm happy with the 66. I am telling you, frankly, the greatest question that I place on the canonization of Scripture being limited to what we now have is the fact that there are only 66 books. There's your clue that Satan moves in on the territory. Pull that camera over this way a little more so I can see all my voices of faith and not have them blocked yet, if you will, please. When you really think about it, do you really believe that God would have the divine Word of God compiled in a package, 66. Now, those who listen to me with critical ears, wanting to hear something, they can run off and say, "Oh, I knew it." will say, he's turned off on the Bible. No, I'm not. I'm turned off on the guys that arranged it. I think they arranged it stupidly. Why don't they tell you in the Bible that when you read in the Kings, you're getting the account from the tribes of Israel frame of reference, and when you're reading in the Chronicles, you're getting the account from the tribes of Judah? Well, the reason they don't is because the Bible as arranged was under the control of people that didn't want to accept that careful distinction that God maintains so much. Do you want to try to count the times that the books of 1st and 2nd Chronicles reference the ministry of Elijah and Elisha? Just go home tonight, you can't go to sleep, and you turn old Scott on and it's something you've heard before. Read the book of 1st and 2nd Chronicles and count the number of times you read about Elijah and Elisha. Now, Jesus said nobody in the world could be a better credential for somebody to come preaching in the spirit of than Elijah. Yet Chronicles records the events of the years of Elijah and Elisha, and you don't have anything. You read it in the Kings, 1 Kings 17. You got the record of Elijah. He's praying, the heavens seal up. And he goes on top of Mount Carmel. And he has the test. Hadn't rained. No rain. Place dried up. So he has a test. We're going to build an altar, and the God that answers by fire will be God. So he said, dig a trench around it. Then get barrels of water. I still remember teaching on Elijah up in Orville. How this silly little... And thank God, this is the only church I've ever pastored that hasn't had a moron in it. Everywhere I've ever been, all my life, there's been an idiot in every church. You know about the one Fresno, sit on the front seat with binoculars, watch the pastor, and when somebody come in, he'd turn around like that. Well, that'll do your anointing in. So we had this idiot little woman. She always sat there on the front seat and looked happy. So I'm preaching, old Sister Gregory. It's her, Sister Gregory. Bless her heart, she's sweet, but she just, the elevator didn't go to the top floor with her. So she's sitting on the front seat, and I'm teaching on Elijah. He had prayed, hadn't rained for 7 years. And he says, build the altar. And you know, people with low-level elevators sometimes see something that other people just go right by. And I really been building it up. He stopped the rain. God said he'd seal up the heavens if they worshiped idols. And Elijah prayed, and it didn't rain. Now he said, we're going to test who's God. Build the altar, dig the trenches, and get barrels of water. And this little old Sister Gregory sitting on the front row says, where did you get the water? Where did you get the water, she said. It hadn't rained for 7 years. That could throw you, you know that? That's a very sensible question. No rain, where do you get barrels of water when it hasn't rained for 7 years? That's when I was glad I knew the geography. So you go down to the bottom of Mount Carmel, and there's the Mediterranean Sea. Now, a long haul, but you can get it. You remember that? I ought to write a book about church experiences. I'm restraining a couple more. You that have figured it out know what I'm doing. I'm restraining. Telling you a couple of more. But you read 1st and 2nd Kings, you get all the details about Elijah. Elijah was a prophet to the 10 tribes of Israel. Ahab and Jezebel ruled over Israel, not over Judah. The reason there is the record of Kings and Chronicles is that you have Judah is in no position to record the record of the 10-tribe kingdom to the north. They kept their own records, which become 1st and 2nd Kings. Chronicles record the happenings of Judah. Now, the 10-tribe kingdom is carried into bondage in Assyria, never to come back. The Judah kingdom is carried into Babylon to return, and Ezra rescues the records. The record of the 10 tribes is over. They're gone. Chronicles is over, but you can pick it up with the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and all the other 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, 1st and 2nd Samuel. Oh, you when I was reading through them, I was wondering, why? You know, I was a kid reading the Bible through. Everybody says, God is excited if you read the Bible through. I mean, it's a great accomplishment. They'd testify to that. I've read it through 5 times. They don't know a thing in the world about it, just read it through 5 times. I mean, those bigots ones, I thought I was reading about bigots. Bigot after bigot. Then I'd get to some stories I didn't dare tell Mom and Dad I read. Nobody ever told me there were some stories in here that I ran into when I read through. And I'd read along in 1st, 2nd Samuel, and then I'd read 1st, 2nd Kings, and read 1st, 2nd Chronicles, and they would dawn on me, you know. Some of this sounds the same. And then I'd get over here in the prophets and read in Isaiah 36 and say, wait a minute, I just read that over in Chronicles. Same record. No sense to the way this is organized. Somebody, you know, started out doing that way and ever since been same time, same place. It doesn't make sense. There needs to be some explanation. Arrange it differently. This is all the book that I need. This is God's book. I know that. I frankly wish there were some more things added to it because I think some other things ought to qualify. And then immediately somebody gets up and says, now listen here. If you add to or take away from this book, all kinds of terrible things will happen to you. John said that about the book of Revelation. He didn't say a thing in the world about the other 65 books. He didn't even have some of them available to read. I mean, but if you got this letter and read the one from Revelation and they showed up later with one you hadn't seen, you wouldn't put it in. When they canonized this scripture, they arranged it differently than I would have. Ezra and Nehemiah ought to be linked to Haggai and Zechariah properly. Malachi was the prophet in conjunction with Nehemiah. Isaiah was the prophet to the southern kingdom. Amos was the prophet to the northern kingdom. He came out of Judah, and when he began to prophesy, the false prophets up in the northern tribes got so mad they told him, go on back home, don't go stirring things up here. Go back to Judah and prophesy. He said, God sent me here. They treated him like a carpetbagger. They reacted like a Yankee that's being told off by a southerner. Jonah was a prophet to Nineveh. They ought to arrange it differently. The book of Kings ought to have some footnotes along the margin that tell you, read this prophet in conjunction with this historic record. So the 66 books are a product of a church that became so contaminated with the devil's influence that it closes the minds of people. There are people that say, well, I mean, if you even act like there's anything else God ever said than these 66 books, then I'm not sure of anything. Baloney. You live in this book long enough, it starts becoming self-convincing if you handle it right. And it makes you hunger for more. I don't need anybody to scare me about the book of Enoch. I can pretty much approach it with the same scholarship that you approach to decide why you'll take Paul's writings instead of Barnabas' letter. And why you'll take the epistle of Paul to Timothy instead of Clement's epistle. The church has been too long scared of truth. And the book of Enoch is long overdue in a fresh examination. And to take part of Enoch does not require you to take all of Enoch, because if you sit down and read the book of Enoch properly, you'll also find out what I've already said. There are sections that could easily be an add-on, claimed to be a vision by Noah. But if Enoch is solid, that book begins to give us a clue. He was taught about the stars by an angel. Enoch becomes the source of the stars. And one more chink in that little wall that leads us to the question, who was the superintendent, if not God's draftsman for the architecture of the pyramid? Was it Enoch? Because of the link-up between the pyramid and the stars, if that book that the New Testament suggests, when Jude says Christ come with 10,000 of his saints, he's quoting Enoch. Straight out of a whole chapter of Enoch is isolated in that quote. And if Enoch has any accuracy at all, Enoch was the person who was taught by an angel whom God charged to teach Enoch, and Enoch was the one that learned and named the stars first. Now, we can't find where the original names of the zodiac came from. You that read the book of Enoch know that he saw them as gates. It was a rather interesting story. I wonder if I got my book of Enoch with me. I'd read it to you tonight. He saw them as gates. And they were on a center band, as we have tried to show what the galaxies of the zodiac are. The 12 major zodiacs get their name not because of size, not because that particular message is more profound than other messages in the decans or pieces alongside, but because they're at the center of the equator in the wall of the room of the heavens. If we've done this several times, that as the sun, as we revolve around it, if you sight in at a given time, the earth looking through the sun at a given time as we go around the sun, we're in a room called the heavens, and the room can be analogized to these walls. And if you draw a line right in the middle of the wall, as you go around the sun the 365 days and sight through the sun at a given point, as we go around the camera being the sun, I'll be looking at my parents at one moment, I'll be looking at that picture at another moment, I'll be looking at these pictures at another moment, and dependent upon the angle and the wobble, I'll be sighting a different direction, either sighting above or below the centerpiece if we drew a line in the middle of the room. That's called the celestial equator in that sense. It's the equator of the room of the heavens. And as we go around, depending upon the wobbling effect and the tilts, you will sight in on galaxies on one side or the other of that center band. Enoch saw what he called the gates of the heavens in a center band all around. And then on each side of the center band, he saw what he called windows. And he named them. Now, as you study the stars, you have got to distinguish between the earliest, most remote names of the stars that consistently give meaning to the figures that are designed, and later additions. And if you can date the later additions that change the oldest zodiacs, that's but one step further corrupting the original meanings conveyed by the names of the stars. And if the book of Enoch is correct, God gave the names of the stars to Enoch. And you got to look to those ancient Akkadian, Sumerian, and Egyptian, the oldest zodiacs. Now, as we move into the last four zodiacal signs and their associated decans, we come to the Day of Judgment, starting with the Taurus, the bull, the ream, the two-horned, fierce, wild ox that comes charging in power on the scene in the Day of Judgment. Those signs, because they are the death knell for Satan and his purposes, are the ones that history at the time of the Greeks and the Romans begin to corrupt and change more than any other signs in the zodiac. So as we move into the last chapters, the last four signs, the bull, Taurus, the twins, Gemini, the crab, as some would have it, Cancer, and Leo, the lion that finishes the trip. Each of those four signs convey a basic message at the Day of Judgment, when God finally accomplishes what has been revealed in the heavens, as Paul said, of the wrath of God against ungodliness. But as we move to these signs, because they tread on the head of the serpent so forcefully and give hope to the redeemed so eloquently, these are the signs that have been most distorted in more recent history, bending the message away from the original picture. And as Joseph Seiss has said in the illustration I've used over and over again, he visited a church, a Muslim church, that had been converted to an Islamic mosque. It was a mosque. It was a Christian church. And they'd painted over a picture of Christ. But he said, in spite of the painting, you could see the glimpses of the original behind it. That's the way you have to look at the stars. And know, as we get into the last four signs, Satan, when he controls the minds of men, has taken this message of God written in the heavens and distorted it more in these last four signs through the Greeks and the Romans than any other distortion. The original signs are harder to dig for, and you have to rely on the names of the stars to give you the consistent meaning more than any of the previous eight signs and their associated decans. As the bull comes on the scene, charging in power in the Day of Judgment, there unfolds the end time events, and Satan doesn't like it. And he'll transfer that sign where the picture of the Lord in his glory and in his might and his power is putting his foot on the head of the serpent or an evil bird, or in the ancient Egyptian zodiac, an evil bird holding an evil serpent. But way back to the most ancient, it is an evil serpent being crushed. Modern Grecian signs turned it into a hare, a rabbit. They carry the name still, the enemy. You look at the stars, and the name will leap out at you. But they've twisted it. The sign of the crab, Cancer, has conveyed the meaning of grabbing and holding tight, but totally distorted the original meaning, which is a fold, a shelter, a place of safety, a place where you're firmly held, best illustrated by an ancient sheepfold, not a crab. Cancer is and carries in a twofold message, as you look at the decans, the safe fold of the redeemed. They twisted the shepherd because he's got a couple of bands loose in his hand. There's nothing other than a symbol of the bands that in the previous picture of the two fish that were bound and the band that was also hooked to the neck of Cestus the sea monster. Or Cestus the sea monster. That great, terrible Leviathan, or all various names of that monster of the deep. also subject to the bands that are under the control of the Lord Himself. The bands have been loosed on His sheep, and the she-goat is in His arms with the kids on His left arm, looking with horror at the charging bull, frightened by that side of the Lord of glory as He charges on the scene, but safe and secure in the arms of the shepherd, not charioteer. He's called a charioteer, and you can date the later editions that twist it from its meaning of a shepherd who holds his own safe in his arms while the day of judgment does its work on Satan and the kings of this earth that have lined up with him. Likewise, the crab conveys the concept of holding tight and safe and secure, but it distorts the original meaning, a sheepfold or a safe place. The hare waters down the vicious serpent crushed under the foot of the mighty one. That's why we have to work with a little more attention as we come into these last signs to not let the later distortion. We know dog days. Well, they got dog major and dog minor. Canis major and canis minor. Same word when we get canine. Big dog and little dog. But I want you to notice, if you got your star charts in the book that you got from me on page 116, I'm tempted to give one of these books to every Gideon this month, because I'm teaching on it so much. You need these charts, and some of you couldn't make it to the King's House that Sunday. But if you got your chart on page 116, you'll notice the main star and the mouth of the dog, Sirius. See right there? Now, Josephus speaks of the sons of Seth making a monument, one of brick and one of stone, before the flood, to preserve the knowledge that God had given them. And the one of brick, he says, has passed away. The one of stone is still standing. That's the first century when Josephus is writing. The one of stone is still standing in the land of Syriac, he says, until this day. That identified Egypt who worshiped this dog star. The dog star hardly says it. You got to come to the meaning of the star Sirius, which is derived from Seir. And Capt is very correct here, though the other books will take it much further. I'll give you a sample of what Bullinger has to say about this star Sirius or Syriac. Just hold on till I find the dog star. Sirius, by the way, our English word, sir, is a cognate derived from that ancient star. And sir is an expression of respect, because this star demanded by its meaning that kind of respect. And in English, the word sir gives you your clue. Now, I'm a dog lover, but a dog just doesn't rise to the meaning of this constellation. And Canis Major and the symbol of the dog is a later addition. Sirius was by the ancients always associated with great heat. In the Dendera zodiac, which is the ancient Egyptian one, he is called by a name which means the head. He is pictured as a hawk, caused to come forth, coming swiftly down. And you know the hawk is the natural enemy of the serpent. In the Persian planisphere, they begin to change it. And it was pictured as a wolf. Plutarch translates it leader. Its ancient names and meanings must be obtained, therefore, since it passed through its earliest picture as a hawk to a wolf to a dog, which waters down the power of its meaning. You will find the consistent meaning in the names of the stars. There are 64 altogether. Two are of the first magnitude. Of these, the one in the head is the brightest star in the whole heaven. There you are. Sirius, the brightest star in the whole heaven. It is called Sirius, the Prince. Originally, Sar. And that's why I say we get Sir from it. Always associated with great heat. And the hottest part of the year, we still call the dog days from that association. Virgil says the Sirius with pestilential heat infects the sky. Homer spoke of it as a star whose burning breath taints the red air with fevers, plagues, and death. But it is not of its heat that its name speaks, but of the fact that it is the brightest of all the stars. Though this dog star came to have an ill-omened association, it was not so in the more ancient times. In the ancient Akkadian, it is called by a name which means the leader or prince of the heavenly host. In the sacred books of Persia, the name means the chieftain of the east. The next star in the left forefoot, Muzam, means the prince or ruler. The bright star in the body, right down here, three bright stars, the one in the mouth, the left foot, and now in the body, means the bright and the shining. The next bright star in the right hind leg means the glorious. Other names have meanings such as this: who shall come? The prince, the chief of the right hand, the prince, the mighty, the leader, the chief. Nowhere in the names of the stars is there a conflicting voice, no discord in the testimony. The names of the stars themselves have no necessary connection to the hawk or the dog. But the stars would suggest that the more ancient ones were the accurate ones, the hawk. Now, this dog is part of the Gemini constellation, and I haven't yet finished Taurus. I leap to it to just illustrate that each of these signs, in their own way, as we move into the four major zodiacal constellations that convey the day of judgment, when the realization of the wrath of God on this sinning world and the enemy of God, Satan, and his cohorts, that's where the prince of this world, when he was in control through mythology and other things, would paint over the image and distort it. And he painted over the symbol of the prince that in the most ancient, the symbol of the leader, the symbol of the bright and shining one, the symbol of the one that comes with great heat to execute righteous judgment, suddenly is shifted from the hawk to the wolf to the dog, but through the picture that is painted over, Canis Major, you still see the reality in the names of the stars and the most ancient zodiac. That'll be true in all the cases, and that's why I have to go more slowly with these final signs than I did earlier. We've already talked the essence of this first of the final four zodiacal signs. Taurus, the bull, charges on the scene. I want that camera. That'll help you. Taurus charging on the scene. The bull, get up here with his horns. And the bright star in his horn is also the star in the foot of that other symbol of our Lord, wounded in the foot. Here he comes charging with power and majesty, and riding on his neck the Pleiades, and the sister constellations, the Hyades, safe and secure as he comes in power and wrath. Now, we've taught on that. I don't want to go through it again. We just weren't able to show the pictures very clearly. That this day of judgment unfolds in this sign of Taurus is further elaborated by the decans that surround Orion, the mighty man who holds in his head, I keep forgetting, this is the camera you got to use, Mike, sorry, who holds in his hand the head of the roaring lion, the devil that's run to and fro seeking whom he may devour, with the club in his hand, with the interesting sword. Get in close on the sword, which from time immemorial has had the head of a lamb on the hilt and a cross formed by that sword. 1 foot over the head of the enemy, which is another sign that the modern painters over of the star have turned into a hare. Now, Orion is a decan of Taurus, but his foot is over this hare, which is not a hare at all. It's the enemy. It's a snake. Out of his foot breaks forth the river of the judge, which is the river of fire, pouring right out of his foot. And the names of the stars let you tell which is the mouth and which is the source. The name of the star at the bottom gives you the name which lets you know it's the emptying portion. As the names at the start of that river of fire that streams across the heavens, the names of the stars tell you it starts there. The foot of Cetus the sea monster trying to hold it back, but to no avail. This decan tells of him coming in judgment and power. The bull charges on the scene, his saints, the Pleiades, and we've talked on it, you know, some call that star in the Pleiades, maybe the center of the heavens, I don't know. The safe place. But the bull charges on the scene. Orion, the mighty man, is another picture of his victorious ability to win the victory and seize the head of the lion. The river of fire comes out of his foot where he's smashing the hare that's part of another constellation. And we come to Auriga the shepherd, which is where I left off. We've had the picture of the mighty bull rushing forth in the fiery river of the judge. Now we see a great shepherd. He is seated upon the Milky Way, holding up on his left shoulder a she-goat. She clings to his neck. Here she is. She clings to his neck and is looking frightfully back down here toward charging Taurus the bull. Back off if you can a bit, Mike. So there you got it. So you can get the angle of her look as she looks down in fear to charging Taurus and is hanging on to the neck of the shepherd. Now, she clings to his neck. In his left hand, he supports 2 little kids. Auriga, he's called, is from a Hebrew root which means a shepherd. It's a beautiful constellation of 66 stars, one of the first magnitude and so on. The brightest star in the body of the goat points her out as the prominent feature of the constellation. Its name in Hebrew means a she-goat, this brightest star. The next star in the shepherd's right hand, the next brightest star, in the shepherd's right hand means band or chain. And one of the meanings is chain of the goats. Points out the truth They're not down there being chained anymore. They're in his arms. The name of another star means a flock of goats. Can there be any mistake, Bullinger says, as to who this shepherd is? For the bright star in his right foot is called Elnath, like another in Aries, which means wounded or slain. And I'll have you notice, I pointed it out earlier, that's also at the point. It fits into two constellations. But the star in the foot of this shepherd means the wounded or slain. The star marking the kids in Hebrew simply translates kids. Now in Latin, the same word carried over. The Hebrew root of ariga is shepherd, but in Latin the word means coachman or charioteer. The band in his right hand being taken as his reins. But the incongruity of a charioteer carrying a she-goat and nursing two little kids never struck the Romans. They apparently weren't bothered by the fact that the charioteer had no chariot and no horses. And as Bullinger says, when man blunders in the things of God, he does it pretty thoroughly. In the zodiac of Dendera, more than 4,000 years ago, ancient Egypt, the man, instead of carrying the sheep, is carrying a scepter, which means scepter and power. But it's a strange scepter, for at the top it has the head of a goat, and at the bottom and below it ends in a cross. You keep tracing these symbols back. You can follow the way in which the original meanings keep being distorted until they get from the shepherd who died for his sheep and now holds them to a charioteer with reins and no wagon and no horse. And Bullinger's right. These three signs, and one of the things I've recommended another little book on to you, Kenneth C. Fleming, and lots of people think that ordinary traditional churchmen don't get on these subjects. Most of these people I'm reading are ordinary traditional churchmen. This is probably one of the better little books, Kenneth C. Fleming, God's Voice in the Star, Zodiac Signs and Bible Truth. Fleming was converted as a boy through ministry featuring slides of Pilgrim's Progress. After graduation from the University of Washington in Seattle, he spent 25 years as a missionary among the Zulu people in South Africa. Since 1977, he has been instructor in Bible and missions at Emmaus Bible School, Oak Park, Illinois. So, you know, those that think that looking at the signs in the heavens is going off the deep end only prove their ignorance. These signs were God's signs, if Enoch is correct, given to Enoch. He gave the names to man. That's why we can't find. You have to probe past the flood in ancient antiquity. And we have no history past the flood in ancient antiquity that will give us this story. They were just always there. What you see is the changing of the names as they go down. But this little book, one thing good about it is it does, though it's black and white, it's black on white instead of the reverse. I need the whole page, Mike. This book, at the start of each chapter, gives you the full picture with the ecliptic equator of the room in the heavens that goes through the main zodiacal sign, in this case Taurus, and then the decans from which we get dec, the pieces on each side being shown in relationship to the centerpiece of that zodiacal section or chapter in the last four, which will be Taurus and Gemini, Cancer and Leo, which all convey the Day of Judgment. Now, Taurus in the center is elaborated in its meaning of God through His Son charging on the scene as the wild bull to execute judgment and vengeance. Who is that Son of Man who comes club in hand to seize the head of the lion, though bruised in the heel, to crush the evil one that's part of another sign, as we'll see later. And from his foot and the crushing comes that river of fire, Eridanus. and safe and secure, and interestingly enough, on the upper side of the ecliptic. And many times in the zodiacal signs, you'll find the lower side teaches the truth. That altar that pours out hell fire pours downward. This river of fire flows downward. Get your kind of there, flows downward. The mighty man that sees the head of that lion, he moves downward and the bull charges downward. But the sheep are safe in the arms of the shepherd. No longer bound as they were in the earlier signs where they are in the sign of Pisces, bound, or the chained woman on this earth. They are safe and secure in the arms of the shepherd. And this day of judgment continues into the second chapter, into the sign of Gemini. Gemini, the twins. What in the world does that convey? With the surrounding decans of the big dog and the little dog and the victim, which we will talk about. That's where we are next time. Again, as you will notice, this preacher has changed the sign and given a better symbol for Sirius than the dog, because the Persians changed the eagle to the wolf, or the hawk to the wolf, and the wolf was changed by the Greeks and the Romans into the dog. It is the prince, the powerful one. So all of these books would be useful, and on this subject, because I won't be, once we've covered it, I want to use it in relationship to Stonehenge and in relationship to a return to Enoch and in relationship to the pyramids. You don't really need all the books. I'm doing the work. But for those that want to know, this one will give you the mythological stories that have been derived from it. Fleming will give you one of the better Christian presentations, but he makes a couple of very serious errors, in my judgment, that we will correct as we go along. Bullinger is the ancient classic on it, and Capt is the one we've given you. Now, that takes us through Taurus, which I was determined to finish tonight, even though we had a recess 2 hours long. Shall I finish with Gemini and with Cancer and with Leo, or just leave us hanging on this? And I think I know what the answer is. Hopefully, this week, we'll finish the stars by Sunday so we can then build on these building blocks and go forward.